My fellow students of theosophy, before I take our study on to its next phase, I want to pick up some of the threads and add a statement by H.P. Blavatsky, which is an essential part of such a study as we are undertaking. In volume 1 and on page 77 of The Secret Doctrine in the Adyar edition, The Secret Doctrine establishes three fundamental propositions, and these are, first, an omnipresent, eternal, boundless, and immutable principle upon which all speculation is impossible, since it transcends the power of human conception and can only be dwarfed by any known expression or similitude. It is beyond the range and reach of thought. In the words of the Mundakya Upanishad, that boundless absolute is unthinkable and unspeakable. It is above every name and is generally indicated by the word that, capital T, capital H, capital A, capital T. Then the secret doctrine establishes a second fundamental proposition as follows. The eternity of the universe in toto as a boundless plane, periodically to become the playground of numberless universes, incessantly manifesting and disappearing. These are called the manifesting stars and the sparks of eternity. Third, the fundamental identity of all souls with the universal oversoul, this latter being itself an aspect of the unknown root. And to this identity of all souls is added the obligatory pilgrimage of every soul through the cycle of incarnation or necessity in accordance with cyclic and karmic law during the whole term. Such, friends, are the three fundamental propositions which every student should carefully follow. And you will notice that the third brings us to ourselves, the human monads, on their pilgrimage through matter to relative perfection, age by age. Have you followed it all right? You'll remember there were three basic principles. First, the absolute, omnipresent, eternal all, boundless and immutable, called by the Kabbalists Ein, meaning no thing, and referred to by Omar Khayyam so beautifully in the Rubaiyat, when he is thinking of the return of the whole Maya, phantom, or illusory forms back into the eternal, saying in effect these words. A moment's halt, a momentary taste of being from the well amid the waste. And lo, the phantom caravan has reached the no-thing it set out from. Oh, make haste. From these three fundamentals, the first of which only I've just drawn attention to, we now turn to the activity of the first creative logos, the architect and fashioner of forms. St. John leads us, you remember from my earlier talks, in the first verse of his gospel, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. This too should be carefully studied, for it enunciates the famous logos doctrine. All is conceived in divine thought, and all is objectively formed by the divine voice. The psalmist expresses the same idea in Psalm 33, verse 6. by the word of the Lord were the heavens made, and all the host of them by the breath of his mouth. In the Egyptian cosmogony, the Creator affirms, I am the great God Nu, who gave birth unto himself, and who made his name to become the company of the gods. Now we're moving on a little towards the idea of the emanated creative intelligences that we shall consider together a little later on. But you know, the Egyptian cosmogony is so very beautiful and wonderful, for in the Book of the Dead, chapter 17, we read, Tahuti, the divine intelligence at the creation, uttered the words which resulted in the formation of the world. He was self-produced and was Lord of earth and air and sea and sky. In Hinduism, the creative power or agency or voice is personified as a goddess named Vah, meaning voice or speech. Vah was generated by the gods and called Divine Queen of the Gods. She is the female Logos, being one with Brahma, who created her out of one half of his body. She, as the female creator, is associated with Brahma in the whole work of creation, which again, you see, is by means of an outpoured creative power of the order or quality of sound. So the creator in the Hindu idea was conjoined with Vah, married her in fact, through his mind, and she produced the universe and all creatures. And so all this is an allegory of the union of power and intelligence to operate the work of creation by sound. Vah is really the creative force, as I've just said, which emanating from the creative deity becomes manifested as the metaphysical word or logos. You see, fellow students, all of these ideas are extremely abstract, formless. They belong to the realm of objectless thinking. And in order that they may be brought within the reach of the normal human mind, then allegories and personifications are used to bring them down to the level of formal, customary thought. And so all these symbols and actions of gods and goddesses are intended to make comprehensible to the human mind, by means of personification, the principles of the rational self-evolution of cosmos and chaos. They all personify attributes and activities of one being, their synthesis, who is the universal creative logos or word. And the active logos is a god who reveals himself in contrast to the absolute, which, so to say, is a god who hides himself. This has led us into the next step in thought, the gradual formation of the idea behind the word, the divine conceiving from which arises the divine idea. Now from this point of view, the whole universe is conceived in divine thought as a creative archetype or idea, and this is held there throughout eternity. This idea is the governing power in creation. And then the creative word, expressive of the idea, is spoken, and the seeds of living things germinate and appear from within the vast ocean of space, the great deep. This archetypal concept in the divine intelligence is also well worthy of our study and even contemplation. Apparently, this concept, this divine idea, is fixed, is permanent. It is not subject to change, either of state or degree of manifestation. The one solar archetype for our universe, the present solar system of which we are inhabitants, for example, the content of the divine thought of our solar logos throughout the whole period of manifestation, the days of Brahma, that divine thought is free of time. It includes within itself every phase of development and every seasonal change in a timeless idea. Can you follow that? I know it's very abstract and difficult. Let's come down, shall we, to our familiar physical nature. Let us take as metaphor the rose. We see and know the rose in all its many forms and varieties, don't we? We know it from the primitive wild to the cultivated state, including all the wonderful variations of color, texture, or fragrance. We, down here in the worlds of form, in our physical bodies, we can watch the growth and unfoldment which occur through the seasons, from the first stage right on to the fully flowered rose. Are we then seeing the reality? No, answers the philosopher. We are seeing the succession of forms and variations of appearance in time. But behind all those and every other change throughout vast ages, there ever exists, or subsists, should I say, roseness. The single divine rose idea, God's wonderful thought of the rose. And this, his thought, this unchanging total concept of the rose as a plant, that is the reality of the rose. And so with everything else down here, sycamore, pine, daffodil, violet, and every species in all the kingdoms of nature, including our own. Behind all of nature's forms is the unchanging unity, the divine thought of all that they are and ever will be to the end of the age, when the perfect rose will bloom down here on earth, as it ever blooms in the heaven of the archetypes, and perfected man will rejoice therein. What a wonderful rose that will be, won't it? It will surely show forth in perfection all that our horticulturalists have been able to produce, but preserving the perfume in all its delicacy and beauty to give us the perfect rose, which Mother Nature down here, in response to the divine voice, expressive of the divine idea, will eventually produce. So you see, the dynamic, changeless, archetypal model and pattern, the single divine idea, this is the reality behind all manifestation. All else, all which changes, is in Hindu philosophy regarded as unreal, illusory, a maya. And this is the maya doctrine, a Sanskrit word which, whilst literally meaning illusion, simply means everything that changes, everything which is out of the eternal, is, from this point of view, an illusion. So there exists above this illusory, ephemeral universe a perfect, invisible universe, which is the real and the true model of the universe below. And the divine quest for us, you know, is to pass through the gateway of the universe of time, of space and variation here below, to pass through that into the universe above, which is timeless and without change. That is why we use that wonderful Hindu mantra, you remember. We say to our own higher selves, the real in us, these words, I'm sure you all know them, lead me from the unreal to the real. From darkness, lead me to light. From death, lead me to immortality. Well, now, back to the procedures of creation from that little philosophic dissertation. We must now consider in a little more detail the projection of the archetype. This, as I've already been saying, is achieved by the metaphorical sounding forth by the Logos of his creative word, according to the Logos doctrine. This is the presentation in sound of the one major pattern in the mount, of which we read in Exodus 25, verse 40. This is the great archetypal form of all that is to be, and it's called in the Bible the pattern in the mount. It must be, as I've been saying, must be composed of innumerable component archetypes of every species of form and being, each having its own cord, the cord of its own being. Like you and I and all other beings have the cord or individuality in terms of keynote, sound and component notes, which is expressive of the reality in each one of us. And these all together make up one total chord or song or word, if you like. In totality, it must be one vast and glorious, all-inclusive sound, expressive of the divine idea. Thus, perhaps, the archetype becomes audible, so to say, and the vast chord shapes responsive matter into living forms. You know, when I was studying these matters and subjects with our members in the HPB Lodge in Auckland, New Zealand, we carried out experiments to see if we could make objective the power of sound to produce a pattern. Well, this is what we did. We took a fairly large teapot. You can all do the same. I recommend it. It's a demonstration of the Logos doctrine before one's eyes, however simply and imperfectly. Well, take a fairly large teapot, take off the lid, and then stretch rubber over the top of the pot, where the lid was. Then take sand and sprinkle it on the rubber evenly. Then, in our case, the different students took turns in humming down the spout so that the teapot inside became resonant with the voice and note which the student was humming into the spout. It was wonderful because as we watched, the different sounds produced set the whole of the air inside the teapot vibrating to the different notes. And these vibrations were transferred to the rubber and so set the little grains of sand dancing in the air. We were able to watch them. And it was then seen when the voice stopped and the sand settled down again, that each note of the scale produced its own regular geometrical pattern. Try it for yourselves if you're interested. We did, and we saw that physical sound is in very truth formative, and that spiritual creative energy with the property of sound could indeed be form-producing. When the vibrations of the voice of God impinge upon the grains of sand, virgin space it means, they tend to draw them into coordinated forms. This will be far more complex, of course, than the form produced by a single note, which is one geometrical design. But it's always the same, we found, the same for each note. But in the divine idea there is a marvelous complexity, an exuberant variety and richness, of course. Hence, down here in nature also, there is the same wondrous variety and richness of individuality, everywhere apparent. And behind every species of form, there is a sounding forth of its formative chord. Now, I hope I've made that part of our study as clear as I have it in my own mind. Admittedly, it is abstract and abstruse. Now we have to take our next step in thought. This form-building process is assisted by the actions of hierarchies of creative intelligences, certain orders of archangels, angelic hosts, and nature spirits, order upon order of the builders of nature's form according to the word. And these are both emanations from and embodiments of universal will and thought. For it is within the Logos itself that the mighty spirits before the throne, the great archangels of the face of God, the hosts of the Logos, the Cosmocratores, as they are severally called, the creative hierarchies of the gods, it is from within the creative Logos that they leap forth from his bosom, as it is said in one old book, and take up their stations in the different centers of the universe to be. These are the aids, assistants, builders of the universe. They know the design and the archetype. They hear the creative word, might we say, if that is not materializing it too much. They hear the creative word and they ally or unify themselves with the form-producing word force. By thus blending themselves, individualized manifestations of the creative idea with the outpoured force, they enhance or amplify its formative capacity. And that, I believe, is the key. These great beings, you know, they live in the superphysical worlds, and they act perpetually as form-molding agencies according to the word. You may have read about them in Oriental philosophy. There in the East, certain of them are called Gandharvas, which we take to mean angels of music. But when we speak of creative music, we should think less of our human kind of music and more of the ever-chanted divine name, the creative word. The Vishnu Purana says of the Gandharvas that they were born from Brahma imbibing melody. Isn't that a wonderful thought? They were born from Brahma imbibing melody. And it goes on to say, imbibing melody, drinking of the goddess of speech they were born, and hence their appellation, Gandharvas. Such beings are Arupa Devas, being denizens of the Arupa or formless world. Meaning, as doubtless you all know, those planes of nature more subtle than that at which the formal mind of man usually functions. We say in technical theosophy, don't we, that all the planes up to from below the fourth subplane of the mental plane, those we call the rupa or form worlds, wherein forms appear. But above that, that means the upper three subplanes of the mental, the buddhic, the atmic, inan, upadaka, and adi, there those are called the formless worlds. It doesn't necessarily mean that there are no forms there, but rather that the tendency for matter is to take forms is subservient to its responsiveness to rhythm and vibrating energy. Whilst here in our physical world, for example, if you put clay into a shape, it will hold it. Something the same applies to the matter of what we call the rupa or form worlds. Water, you know, gives us an idea of the formless worlds. It has no shape. It will, by force, take the shape of a container, like a tumbler from which you're going to drink, but pour it back and all shape that we can see is gone, isn't it? So we have the rupa and the arupa worlds. Now there are archangels and angels in these worlds. They are the great and lofty ones, like the Gandharvas, arupa devas, being denizens of the arupa or formless worlds, meaning, as I've just been saying, those planes of nature more subtle than that at which the formal mind of man usually functions. What do they look like? Well, as far as my very limited sight has revealed them to me, to clairvoyant vision, they resemble centers of consciousness and force, from which brilliantly coloured radiations extend on every side. But, you know, there is a faint suggestion of an idealised, gloriously beautiful, human-like form. Quite definitely, this is received, as you may have noticed in the pictures in my book, The Kingdom of the Gods. In bringing the result of such a vision, however, into the brain mind, it can and surely does, save in the very lofty spheres, much materialized, formalized, and so marred. But if this limitation be remembered, I will attempt a description of them in the next study that we carry out together.